What do you think it would be like to have Jesus as a dinner guest?
She handled it better than I would.
She handled it better than you would? How would you handle it?
I would still be stuck.
He'd still be standing at the door.
It made me question if anything I had prepared or just had was good enough if he showed up.
Okay. It would make you wonder if you have everything kind of in its proper place. I want to pick Jesus' brain. Got all kinds of things I want to ask him. Is that pretty well what everybody would say somewhere along one of those responses? More than any other gospel, Luke's gospel brings out the fact that Jesus did a ton of ministry around the table with people. We read specific stories where he's sitting at table with someone, and we read these summaries where people just allude to the fact that he has a habit of eating with people. And the episodes that we get are just kind of a sampling. So there are three main groups of people that Jesus eats with, three types of dinner parties that he goes to. Can anybody guess what those three main types, three groups are? The wedding. Okay, well, the wedding feast is actually in the Gospel of John. So that would be a fourth one. That's a valid answer, though.
Sinners.
He eats with tax collectors and sinners. He eats with his disciples. And he eats with religious leaders. So what I want to do this morning is look at the three different types of dinner parties that he goes to. And the first one I want us to think about is the times that he goes to dinner with Pharisees. There are three different times in the Gospel of Luke where Jesus is said to be at dinner with Pharisees. And I have them there for you. Chapter 7, verse 36. 11, verse 37, and chapter 14. In chapter 7, in fact, we'll just go ahead and turn there. Chapter 7, verse 36. One of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and reclined at table. And behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment, and standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head and kissed his feet and anointed them with the ointment. So, and the story goes on. We're not going to read the whole story, but Jesus is invited into the home of a Pharisee. And a woman comes in who is known for her sinfulness. And the Pharisee, how does he feel about this when he sees this happen? You guys remember the story? Is he happy or not happy? Not happy. Which is a safe answer. The Pharisees are never happy. Man, that's true. That's worth thinking about. But he's not happy. He scoffs that Jesus would let a sinner touch him. And so Jesus responds with this riddle. If two debtors are both forgiven a debt, which one is going to love the lender more? And the Pharisee answers, well, the one who is forgiven more is going to love more. And Jesus is like, exactly. This is why she's so thankful. She apparently has come into contact with Jesus before. She comes in. This is like an act of gratitude that she's weeping and anointing his feet. In chapter 11, verse 37. While Jesus was speaking, a Pharisee asked him to dine with him. So he went in and reclined at table. The Pharisee was astonished to see that he didn't first wash before dinner. And the Lord said to him, "Now, you Pharisees cleanse the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness." The rest of the chapter is Jesus saying, "Woe to you, and woe to you, and woe to you," for all of these different things. But they're all different. All of the woes are, there's something going on in your heart that is masked by the way that you behave on the outside. And you think that because the outside looks good, that the inside is good, but it's not. All right. Any thoughts or quick reflections on that story? Okay. The fourth story is in chapter 14. One Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees, they were watching him closely, or carefully. And behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus responded to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. Then he took him and healed him and sent him away. And he said to them, "Which of you, having a son or an ox that's fallen into a well on a Sabbath day, will not immediately pull him out?" And they could not reply to these things. And then he goes on to tell two parables, both about feasts, while he's still sitting there at table with them. So this is apparently, because this is the Sabbath, this is apparently like the equivalent of the after church Sunday afternoon lunch over at the Pharisee's house. This is like they went over to the preacher's house for lunch. And there is a man there who has dropsy. Perhaps this man is a Pharisee himself. I don't know. But he's there. And Jesus, not only does he heal him, he teaches the rest of the dinner guests not to seek out places of honor, but to invite the poor and the destitute whenever they have a dinner party. Now, what do you notice when we put those three stories side by side? Does anything stand out to you?
He attacks him in all three.
He attacks him in all three. Yep. Any other?
Jesus has compassion on the down and out.
He has compassion on the down and out. In at least two of the cases, there's somebody there who is... It's kind of surprising that they're there. Mm-hmm. And Jesus' posture toward them is compassion, while the Pharisees' posture toward them is maybe not right now or something else. Anything else that you notice?
First, he was invited. And the last one, he was having dinner with him.
Yeah, since he's at the ruler's house, you kind of assume, even in the third one, that he's invited. All right, so some common threads between all three of them. In all three stories, the Pharisees show a concern for decorum. For the Pharisees, the dinner table, the dinner party, is a place of order. It's a place of appearance and ritual and proper action. And so she shouldn't be here, and you're supposed to wash your hands, and you're not supposed to heal on this particular day at this particular meal. It's like dinner with the Pharisees seems very formal and very stylized. Have you ever been to a dinner like this? Very formal. There are like rules about the way you're supposed to eat and talk and who's invited and all this. You know what I'm talking about? Okay. Some of you do. That's good. The rest of this is going to be lost on the rest of you. But four of us are going to have class this morning. Is Jesus concerned about decorum? Doesn't really seem like he is. He almost seems to make a point of chucking the decorum. Which I don't think he does it just for the sake of... He's not an anarchist, just getting rid of decorum for the sake of getting rid of decorum. But always to make a point. In all three stories, Jesus' actions or his inaction, not washing his hands, scandalize the Pharisees. At all three times, when Jesus goes to dinner with a Pharisee, he will do something that offends their sensibilities. When he allows the woman to touch him, he doesn't wash his hands, he heals on the Sabbath. All three times, he makes the Pharisees gawk. And then in all three, he winds up teaching the host about grace. In all three, he is a guest. Jesus is not the host, except in a theological sense of Jesus is the host of every table that he sits at. But he's invited to their house. And in all three, his scandalizing action becomes an opportunity for him to teach. And the message is one of grace, that she has been forgiven much, and that's why she loves much. You Pharisees are living a lie, and he's calling them to an inner transformation. And any day is a good day to be set free. Yeah.
The thing I also noticed is that it felt like they were inviting him for a trap in order to catch him. And so, but their evil intentions, he still used them for a good intention.
So this was a business lunch. I say that kind of tongue in cheek, but this is not about just enjoying a meal together. This is about something else.
And like I said, the odd thing, why would the one with dropsy and the lady that was, you know, the sinner, why would they be in their house normally? So they would have to somehow probably bring them in to see what he would do.
All right. Any other thoughts on the three stories?
Even for the Pharisees, most translations load to you Pharisees. The New English Bible actually says, alas for you Pharisees. Even for the Pharisees, Christ had a concern. Mm-hmm. He wanted them to know that they had taken themselves into harm's way. But there was still a possibility of repentance if they would listen.
Yeah.
So even though he was condemning them, he was also voicing his concern for them.
Yeah, he's doing something prophetic in saying the way that you're going right now is unsustainable, but there is a window of opportunity, like we talked about last week. There's still hope, but it's going to require transformation. Okay, let's talk about another kind of dinner party that Jesus goes to, and that is when he eats with tax collectors and sinners. And I realized after I picked that picture that this is probably like a youth group or something. And the point is chaos. Okay, Jesus more famously goes to dinner parties with tax collectors and sinners, which I think is probably less prim and proper than eating with the Pharisees. So three different stories. The first, in chapter 5, that is the story of Matthew, or in Luke, he's called Levi, the tax collector. Jesus finds him at the tax collector's booth and says, come, follow me. And then he goes over to Levi's house, and Levi has all of his tax collector friends come over, and they're having a party together. And the Pharisees are walking by, it's tight quarters, and they look in the window and see what's going on, and they say, hey, psst, why does your master eat with tax collectors and sinners? And Jesus says, what? No, it's not the healthy who need a doctor. It's the sick. I haven't come to call the righteous, but sinners. And then chapter 7, verse 31 to 34. This is part of his... is this part of his Sermon on the Plain? It is not. It is not. Oh, this is the centerpiece of the Gospel in Action section where he's talking about John the Baptist. And he says, he says, you people are like children in the marketplace who sing this song, we sang a happy song for you and you didn't laugh. We sang a sad song, you didn't cry. Whatever we do, it doesn't matter. You can't be changed. And so John the Baptist came along and he fasted. He didn't eat or drink. And you all thought that he had a demon. And then I came along and I ate and drank. And you call me a glutton and a drunkard. What do you want? We can't win with you people. Well, what's interesting to me about that is Jesus is being accused of being what? He says it in verse 33 or 34.
A glutton and a drunkard.
Is he, do you think, walking around with tiny little bits of bread and sipping from his tiny little water bottle? No, he's feasting. And feasting is apparently a regular enough occurrence in his life that he can be accused of being a glutton and a drunkard. Now, I think that there's some connection there to Deuteronomy 20:21, I think. When there's a rebellious son, and if your son's not accepting correction, you bring him to the chiefs of the city, and you say, "This son of ours is a glutton and a drunkard, and he's not responding to our discipline." Anyway, that's the second story. Third story is much longer, 2.5 chapters. And it begins in chapter 15, verse 1, where Jesus is once again eating with tax collectors and sinners. And the Pharisees once again say, "What is he doing eating with tax collectors and sinners?" And then Jesus goes on to tell 5 parables. The parable of the lost sheep, parable of the lost coin, the lost son, which we looked at those 3 in 1 week. And then the parable of the unjust steward, and the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. I did it. And all of these stories together are about Jesus's pursuit. Well, the first 3 stories are about Jesus's pursuit of sinners. And each of those first 3, the lost sheep, lost coin, and lost son, end with a celebration about the incorporation of the one who was lost. Seems like a very chatty dinner party that Jesus is just telling story after story after story. So a few things to notice about his dinner party with sinners. Jesus is regularly accused of fraternizing with the wrong people. This is a standard criticism of Jesus. That's probably one that I think we're already familiar with. The second, dinner with Jesus is a celebration, not a sack lunch. It's a feast. When you eat with Jesus, it is a feast. The parable of the lost things all include, "Hey, come to my house and we're going to have a party and let's kill the fatted calf because the son of mine was lost, but now he's found." When Jesus sits at dinner with sinners, it is not somber. It's festive. Why? Or like, to what end? What is the purpose of having a festival, a feast with sinners?
To celebrate. The idea is they're no longer lost.
No, they're no longer lost. And that is a good thing. The sinners are not coming back to the Lord with their hat in their hands. Or he doesn't need them to have their hat in their hands. But they come back joyfully. And then third, I think this is important. For Jesus, the dinner table foreshadows the great banquet of Judgment Day. I don't know what you associate with Judgment Day, heaven. But what Jesus seems to associate with the new world, the new creation, is that there's going to be a huge party. And when Jesus has a party with sinners, that is in some way a small participation in what's coming later. A table that is attended by all kinds of people in love and mercy and justice, that's forged on the back of forgiveness and grace, that's the kind of table that Jesus wants to sit at. And I think that's also what drove, that was like the heartbeat of the Apostle Paul's mission. As he went around the Roman Empire, he had this vision of this dinner party comprised of a Parthian and a Mede and a Roman and a Greek and a Jew and an Ethiopian and slaves and free and men and women, all together in the name of the Lord Jesus, in the confidence of his forgiveness and his mercy. That was unprecedented in the ancient world. It is hard for us to imagine how revolutionary the idea of a multi-ethnic, economically diverse table was. That was revolutionary. And so for Jesus, sitting at table with sinners is foreshadowing the great banquet that will come in the new world. All right, we got to hoof it. We got another kind of dinner party that Jesus goes to. He eats with his disciples. It's the third kind of dinner party. What's interesting to me is that there are only two stories in the entire Gospel of Luke where he's eating exclusively with his disciples. Can you guess what these two stories are? You probably can. Last Supper is one of them. Last Supper is the first one.
After the resurrection.
There you go. So, in the first story, he's in the upper room with his disciples. He's about to be crucified. It's actually not a really long story. It's only maybe half a chapter. We just, in John, we're talking, on Wednesdays, we're going through John, and we talked about the upper room. He's in the upper room for like seven chapters in John. But in Luke, half a chapter. Very quick. And he basically includes the establishment of the Lord's Supper. How is the Lord's Supper related to his table ministry? What does that have to do with that? Have we ever thought about this? Fellowship. It's almost like it's an act of community or communion with each other. Yeah. Have we ever stopped to think about the Lord's Supper as a continuation of Jesus' table ministry, where he continues to offer grace and he continues to call for an inner transformation, where it continues to be a celebration and a foreshadowing of the great banquet? Okay, it's a continuation. Last November, some of the leadership went to the Right Now Media Conference up in Plano, Carrollton, somewhere up there. And one of the presenters suggested, first of all, maybe we should try having a weekly Lord's Supper, because it's like it's a room full of mostly Baptists. And I just leaned forward because I had a big Church of Christ on the back of my shirt, and I was like, yeah, weekly Lord's Supper. But she said, maybe we should try a Lord's Supper every week because it keeps us accountable. Because you can't stand in the pulpit and say, you people need to do X, Y, and Z before God will love you. But everybody's welcome at the table. The table keeps us accountable because it's this free meal from Jesus. It grounds us in grace. At this table, all the wrong people are invited. I love that. It is foreshadowing of the great banquet. Okay, how are we doing? Doing good? The second story, I should put this up there. The second story in chapter 24 is after the resurrection. The disciples, two of the disciples, are on their way back home, going to the city of Emmaus, about 7 miles away from Jerusalem. And this stranger comes alongside them and starts to talk to them and says, What are you guys talking about? And they said, well, haven't you heard about Jesus and all these things that he did? And of course, who is the stranger? is Jesus. They don't recognize, their eyes are kept from recognizing him. They don't see him for who he is. They don't perceive, they don't discern the presence of Jesus in their midst. And he's teaching and teaching and teaching them about the scriptures. And something in their hearts is aflame. But they can't, they still don't know that it's him. And they say, you should come in and sit down at table with us. It's getting late. Jesus is like, I got to go see, almost said go see a man about a horse, but that means something else. I got to go on. And they said, no, come and stay with us. And so he goes in, he's invited to their table, but instead of them taking the bread and being the host, he becomes the host. And he takes the bread and he gives thanks and he broke it and gave it to them, which sounds a whole lot like what he does in the first story. And it said, as soon as he does that, their eyes were opened and they recognized him. And as soon as they recognize him, what happens? He disappears. And then they hoof it back to Jerusalem because they got to tell the apostles, we saw Jesus. And then look at the last verse of the story, verse 35. Actually, we got to back up to 28. I think. Yeah, 28. So as they drew near to the village to which they were going, he acted as if he were going further. But they urged him strongly, saying, stay with us, for it's toward evening and the day is now far spent. So he went in to stay with them. And when he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened and they recognized him. And he vanished from their sight. Literally, it's he became invisible. They said to each other, did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures? And they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem. And they found the 11 and those who were gathered together, saying, the Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon. And then they told what had happened on the road and how he was known to them in the breaking of the bread. He was made known to them in the breaking of the bread. Isn't that what happens every time we receive the supper together? As we pass the stray down the road, Jesus is made known to us in the breaking of the bread. And we discern his presence with us. And isn't that what happens every time the Lord's people eat together? That we learn to discern the Lord's presence. David Fitch, in his book, Faithful Presence, says this. Here, that is, here at the Lord's Supper, we can recognize and receive the forgiveness that flows from his broken body into our lives, the healing of reconciliation, the renewal of all things through the cup of the new covenant relationship we have with God the Father through the Spirit. If we can recognize his presence at work around the table, we will be able to recognize his work in the rest of our lives as well. If we can be trained into its logic of forgiveness, reconciliation, and renewal on Sunday, we can recognize that same logic of his presence in the world. Without such a discipline, however, we will always be tempted to take God's work into our own hands instead of recognizing his work, submitting to, and participating in it. The table on Sunday morning trains us to discern Christ's presence in all the other places we eat during the week. The Lord's Supper trains us to discern the presence of Jesus wherever we eat. Which brings us to the discipline of eating. When we think of the great spiritual disciplines, what are the first things that come to mind for you?
Prayer.
Fasting.
Bible reading.
The assembly, gathering together. We probably don't think about eating as a spiritual discipline. But perhaps one of the great overlooked and under-practiced disciplines is the discipline of the table. We know that actual meals around actual tables continued to be a practice in the church. Not just, you got to have breakfast, you got to have lunch, but this vision of the Parthian and the Mede and the Roman and the Greek and the slave and the free all gathering together. That continued to be a practice. It's what Jesus did, and he did it a lot. Enough that he was being accused of doing it with all the wrong people. And we know that it continued to be an area of contention. You think about Galatians 2, where Paul and Peter argue about the fact that Peter refused to eat with the wrong people. Or Acts 15, can Jews and Gentiles eat together? The only reason that that continued to be a problem was that the discipline of the table continued to be an actual practice. It's often pointed out that the Lord's Supper was originally done in the context of a meal. But rarely have I ever heard any push for eating together to become a disciplined practice. I've been asked how my prayer life is. I've never been asked how my table practice is. If I'm eating with enough of the wrong people. I've never been asked if I'm spending enough time just eating with other Christians. When was the last time that an unbeliever invited us to their house for dinner? Family doesn't count. That's different. When was the last time that we invited an unbeliever to come into our home for dinner? It seems that the table ministry of Jesus, which was so important to him, has faded into the background. And you notice the only instruction that he gives as we continue this practice is about the guest list. His only instruction is when you hold a party, make sure you bring all the wrong people. Bring in the poor, the lame, the crippled, those who can do nothing to repay you. Why is eating together so important?
Fellowship.
Fellowship? Why is fellowship important? What does that do?
It allows you to get to know the people that you associate with.
Okay.
Chat, talk.
Slow down in relationship.
Say again?
Slow down in relationship.
Slow down? Boy, slowing down is something I probably should have done this morning, huh?
I think when you're eating together, you're, you know, mutually, supporting your physical well-being. But when you're, you know, doing the fellowship and you're, you know, sharing, you know, the word of the Lord, you're helping with the, your spiritual well-being. So it kind of goes hand in hand. Physically being healthy, and you're spiritually being healthy, and you're helping each other, you know, towards it.
Now, kings and paupers both have to eat. And so food is the great equalizer. You can't say, I'm better than you, when you're both sharing a plate of French fries. All right. Few ideas for homework. Next week we're going to talk about Jesus' time in Jerusalem from triumphal entry to the crucifixion. So if you want to read ahead, Luke 20 to 23, you can skim the Gospel of Luke, make a note of every time Jesus is at table. Maybe invite someone to dinner who can't repay you. That sounds like something Jesus would have us do. Maybe have someone to dinner without cleaning up first so that they see who you are, not this prim and proper cleaned up decorum version. And then accept a gift, which we didn't have time to talk about gifts and hospitality, but all right, that's it. Thank you guys. Next week.